CBUT Channel 2, Vancouver.
The flights of Apollo 11, man's first attempt to walk on the moon. Hello again. Well, I'm sure many of your friends will be saying to you 10, 15 years from now, and what were you doing at 4:17 in the afternoon Eastern Daylight Time on July 20th? You probably won't forget it because it has been that kind of a day. And we have another time to contend with now because the latest word on the moonwalk is 9:40 Eastern Daylight Time. And that fits in pretty well right across the country because it gives Vancouver a time of 6:40 for the live moonwalk and 10:40 in the Maritimes and 11:10 out in Newfoundland. So most people will be up and watching one of the most exciting, if not the most exciting moment in all time.
Mike Collins, who remains in the command module, playing a very important part in this flight. He has to constantly fly the mission of the lunar module in a sort of a mirror image so that he can go down and rescue them once they're up to 10 miles off the moon's surface, that is, when they blast off from the moon again. He was flying that same capability as they made the descent toward the moon. He cannot do anything for them if they're below 10 miles down on the Earth's surface. There are terrain features of the moon that would prevent an orbital flight around the moon lower than 10 miles. CBS News color coverage of the epic journey of Apollo 11 will continue in a moment.
There was one more check that needed to be made, and once Rusty Schweikert's stomach settled down, it was done on Apollo 9. Even in his sharply reduced EVA, he was able to prove the reliability of the moonwalk suit and the backpack. Just getting in and out through the small M hatch was an important test. So now it is up to Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to put everything together for their moonwalk. They have spent long hours perfecting their procedures, rehearsing each step. But just how much they can do, how easy it will be to move around, how much heat load their spacesuits will be able to handle, those questions can't be answered until they get there. Aldrin, for one, expects it to be easier than his Gemini 12 spacewalk where there was no gravity at all.
The basic purpose of our space program, of course, has been to land man on the moon, and we're pretty sure now we know how to do it. We are less sure, however, what we can reasonably expect him to accomplish once he gets there. David Shoemaker, CBS News, Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston.
Besides the micrometeoroid impact that we were talking about, there will be that problem of movement on the moon. It's 1/6 gravity there, of course. That means that these men will weigh just 1/6 of what they do on Earth. That means also that with the same muscular tension, with the same use of the legs or the arms, a man can take giant-sized steps because he would move really 6 times as far as he would on Earth with a single step. And that is difficult to control, as these men have tried, as found out with the experiments here on Earth, walking in a kind of a slingshot, a so-called Peter Pan rig, like Peter Pan making those flying trips on the stage, you know. Well, they suspended them in a harness and put them on their sides and then let them walk against a large board down Langley Field to simulate 1/6 gravity. And they found that once you start bounding across this thing, and I took this little test, it's hard to stop. So they're going to go very carefully on the moon to avoid eventually bounding so high that they fall over. It's not easy to get back on their feet in those big, heavy spacesuits with the air pressure in them that gives them very little mobility. They can only raise their arms up about shoulder high and reach down about as far as their knees. Getting back up into an upright position from that would be difficult. One reason why they'll be very careful to avoid falling into a small crater, and why the position of the sun is terribly important so that they can see those craters and will not fall into them. CBS News color coverage of the epic journey of Apollo 11 will continue in a moment.
For opening the hatch door and stepping down, 9:32, so 9:32, 9:40 will be the walk time. In that period somewhere.
This is the earliest possible time, or this is when it's actually going to take place?
He says that, well, as I understand it, that is the earliest possible time it could happen. And you know how these things go, of course.
How are they getting on with this business of putting the suits on, which is supposed to take, what, nearly 2 hours?
Well, they've had that, they will have that two-hour period complete at 9:32 or 9:30. So any time after 9:30, so if you're sitting at home
watching the coverage. Remember that, 9:30 Eastern Time, three quarters of an hour from now, right, as I read it on this clock over here, 44 minutes from now, to be exact, is the time that everyone should be in front of the television set to watch the moon walk, the first time man attempts to walk on the moon. Now, back to CBS.
I don't know that anything can match the excitement of that landing on the moon, successful landing on the moon of a few hours ago, unless it's man stepping out on the moon, and that's due to come 45 minutes from now. The hatch is due to be opened. The men are getting on their spacesuits, their helmets, their gloves, their boots, even at this moment, and donning their portable life support system that will give them 4 hours of oxygen and of cooling water supply and provides their communications. They're getting that on now, and they're due to open the hatch just about 45 minutes from now. One who must have been one of the most excited with this landing today is Dr. William Pickering, the director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and one of the dreamers and workers toward this day. He's with Bill Stout at North American Rockwell in Downey, California. Particularly, I think, if any could be singled out in the White family. Ed White, who was our first space walker, his father is a general in the Air Force, and he went right out and spoke for the space program around the United States, as he's continued to do, to impress people with the necessity for the program to go on and how his son would have wished for it to go on. And today, Pat White, widow of Ed White, was one of the first neighbors to rush into Neil Armstrong's home there in outside of Houston at the Space Center. She still lives there with the White children. She was there to offer her congratulations, smiling, happy congratulations. She said, "I couldn't be happier. It's the culmination of a dream, a culmination for a lot of people. Ed would have been thrilled to see this day come." The lunar module, we have been told now by Houston, is so positioned on the moon that the leg, one of the four legs of the lunar module with the ladder on it, the nine-step ladder that will take man down to the surface of the moon, is turned about 13 degrees south of the ground track. That is, it's facing a little bit west of, or south of west, as the lunar module sits on the moon. Therefore, will be in the shadow of the sun, which is behind the lunar module. As the men get out, about 40 minutes from now.
Good evening. When the first American astronaut steps out onto the surface of the moon, this is what he'll be wearing. It's called an extravehicular mobility unit, better known as a space suit. And the people who built it call it the astronaut's own personal spacecraft, since it has incorporated in it all the systems the spacecraft does to keep the astronaut alive and, above all, protected from the totally alien environment all around it. Now, probably the first thing you notice about this suit as I talk is the constant hiss in the background behind my voice. Well, the astronaut learns to live with that. That's why he's alive. It's a noise made by the inflow of the air into his suit, which either comes, if he's in the spacecraft, through a tube like that, or if he's outside, coming in through from his backpack strapped on the back there. The whole suit weighs more than I do, and it's tremendously complicated and cumbersome, obviously because it's not meant to be worn walking around in the full gravity of Earth. It takes the astronauts, after some years of practice, only 5 minutes to put it on and take it off. It takes me a lot longer than that without help. So to show you how it's made up, I'm going to get some help to, as it were, do a space undress. First off are the extravehicular gloves, the gloves that are worn when the astronaut's outside the spacecraft. They unlock from a metallic ring on the sleeve and are covered with layers of insulating material. Each glove is tailored to fit each astronaut's individual hands. On his back, the emergency oxygen supply and backpack. Now that's what keeps him alive when he's out on the lunar surface, or doing some extravehicular activity in space, walking between the two spacecraft. That, for example, is necessary possibly during an emergency. That has enough systems on board to keep him alive, warm, and relatively happy for 4 hours. On his head, there are three basic sets of visors. The first one, going down now, is the visor that protects against meteorite impacts. And the second one, going down now, gold-covered, protects against glare. And they are fitted on to a kind of over-helmet, which comes straight off, revealing underneath the basic plastic pressure helmet. This is the seal that keeps the astronaut alive when he's inside the suit, and the seal is undone simply by unscrewing the pressure helmet from, and with a little difficulty in my case, from the top of the neck of the suit. Underneath the basic pressure helmet, the communications helmet with small microphones and earpieces in order to communicate with either the spacecraft or via the spacecraft mission control at Houston back on Earth. You notice there the change in noise as the pressure helmet came off. Now this air that's entering through the tube is venting itself up behind my head. On his feet, the astronaut has, as he's out on the lunar surface, lunar overboots. And these are popped on and strapped. And they go on over the top of the basic integral suit boot. And as this one comes off, you'll see that the boot itself, the basic boot, is part of the leg of the spacesuit itself. And what's left is this, the integrated thermal meteoroid garment, which does exactly what it says. It keeps the astronaut warm and it protects him from meteoric impact. It's covered all over with flaps and pockets and controls and containers. And before we show you what's underneath, let's get some more help and get this nozzle, air nozzle, undone. And take out the communications links. And now you'll see just how difficult it is for those astronauts to get the garment off in space.
En dat moeten ze dus uitdoen in de...
Twee uur.
If you can do that in a spacecraft, then you've got good reason to go to the moon. Here then, the entire outer part of the spacesuit. And so the astronaut outside his spacecraft has now only one more garment underneath. This one, the liquid cooling garment, as it's called. And it answers the problem that they discovered on the Gemini flights, related to the fact that once in an extravehicular spacesuit, an astronaut can get extremely hot doing very simple tasks. This garment answers that problem. Cooling liquid is pumped in through these large tubes and then routed away through lots of very small tubes that run along next to the astronaut's skin and tacked on behind the nip-like substance of this garment. And Rusty Schweikart describes the effect of this garment as being very pleasant, like stepping into a cold shower. And from there, we're left with two understandably very basic problems. How do they deal with their waste products? Well, liquid waste is piped away along a permanently attached tube to a metallic reservoir that's set here on the stomach. And solid waste is dealt with by these underpants filled with a highly absorbing material and acting rather like baby nappies. So that's it, down to the skin. And after all that performance, it doesn't surprise me that all the astronauts want to do when they get back to Earth is head straight for the bath.
James Burke of BBC in a comic conclusion to what was a very informative little demonstration of the extra-vehicular suit, the spacesuit that men will wear in their first excursion to the moon, and that's due about 25 minutes from now.
With regards to Mr. Nixon, we now understand that Mr. Nixon is going to attempt to talk to the astronauts on the moon approximately 55 minutes after they start their walk. Now, the latest time we had, just before going on the air, was they would start the walk at approximately 9:32 Eastern Daylight Time, which is 19 minutes from now, which would, Mr. Nixon would presumably talk to them at around 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. What sort of coverage do you think the Russian press is going to give this?
Well, up to now, they have been devoting very little to it. They've been noting it and so forth. Now, the Voice of America, however, is beaming all of this in Russian translation behind the Iron Curtain. They have two men down at it's New York or Washington. I forget exactly where the VOA transmitter is, but probably they'll be in New York because it's a little simpler. But they are beaming this all behind the Iron Curtain, and they are estimating, or possibly guesstimating might be the more apropos phrase, that they are getting very, very large listener audiences behind the Iron Curtain.
Fine. We're going to have a little music now, and very shortly we hope to be joining NBC for the detailed coverage of the moonwalk. With NBC.
Strong and Edwin Aldrin now have been on the surface of the moon, still in their lunar module, for about 5 hours. In approximately 15 minutes, they will open the LEM hatch, and another page in this dramatic adventure will become history. 38-year-old Neil Armstrong to be the first man to step on to the lunar surface. Jay, before the LEM hatch is opened, it's necessary to depressurize the lunar module cabin. What is the significance in this?
Well, the outside environment around the moon is at vacuum. It's absolute zero, Russ. And being that we're used to living in pressure here on Earth, the pressure is 15 pounds per square inch at sea level. Man has to have pressure on his body at all times. And they maintain a pressure of 3.5 pounds per square inch inside the cabin. And in order to get outside, they have to let this pressure out. They have to equalize the pressure when they wouldn't have enough strength to open the door, or if it opened outward as it does, it would open in a hurry and fly off. So what they do is they depressurize, equalize the pressure outside and inside. At the same time, they have their suits pressurized, and then they can open the door, come in or out. They have to keep it equalized here on Earth or on the moon. In this case, it's absolute vacuum.
The original flight plan called for the EVA, that is the extravehicular activity, the moonwalk, as we're calling it so often, had been set for sometime after 2 o'clock tomorrow morning Eastern Time. But the option was always there for the men to move this up if they cared to. They decided to go ahead. The men had about, between 5 and 6 hours sleep last night. According to Dr. Charles Berry, the flight surgeon, they were well rested. They were obviously very pleased at the smoothness with which the lunar landing was carried out. So the EVA has been moved ahead by about 5 hours. NBC Radio's coverage of the flight of Apollo 11 will continue after this message. More than 10 minutes away from EVA, extravehicular activity, the moment at which the hatch on the lunar module is to be open and spacecraft commander Neil Armstrong starts moving out down that 9-step ladder to the lunar surface. All still going smoothly. The command ship is still in lunar orbit. It's
completing Rev 16 now, I believe.
Completing 16. It must be on the backside of the moon now, out of voice contact. In any event, the command ship is still in lunar orbit. The lunar module has been now down on the surface of the moon for better than 5 hours. All still going very well. The moonwalk moved up considerably. The two flyers deciding they would rather go ahead now to conduct this dramatic first step onto the lunar surface.
As you said, Russ, we're completing Rev 16 now with the command module Columbia. We're just beginning 17, and Michael Collins is 69 miles high on the backside of the moon. Everything is underway here. Four of the go for the extravehicular activity on the outside of the moon. Once astronaut Neil Armstrong goes out the hatch, he'll go out backward, feet first, on his hands and knees, and he'll start backing down a 9-step ladder down one of the four legs on the lunar module and down to the foot pad itself. Once he's there and he's steadied himself, then he will gingerly place his left foot onto the surface of the moon to test it before he steps off of the landing craft foot pad onto the surface of the moon. After he's there and he's sure he has his balance, then the astronaut will begin collecting 2 pounds of what they call grab a sample of the moon material. This is in case he has to get back into the spacecraft in a hurry. At least he'll have a little something to bring back with him from the moon. He'll stow this 2 pounds of grab sample into a pocket on the left leg of his space suit. And after he's been out there for a while, astronaut Edwin Aldrin will join him. That will be about 20 minutes after Armstrong goes onto the lunar surface. And then they'll begin setting up experiments. They have, in some way, where some people's thinking, they have two major experiments. Actually, some claim three. They have a solo bring back with them, and they have two that they'll leave. And those two are the seismic station that they will leave to measure moonquakes and the moon's wobble and what have you after they come back to Earth for scientists here. And they'll also leave a laser reflecting mirror on the surface of the moon. They'll place these up. And also they will plant out there the American flag. It will be planted and left. It's a nylon flag, and it has a spring wire in the top of it that will make it furl out and stick out and on the moon, because we have to remember at all times that the moon is airless. There's nothing up there to make, to hold up a flag as we know it here on Earth, so they have to display it in this manner.
Scientists, in laying out these experiments while the men are conducting their some 2 hour, 40 minute extravehicular activity, scientists have set up a priority list for these experiments. And number one on the scientific priority is the contingency sampling. Whatever else happens, they want to bring back a sampling of the moon's surface. So that will be the first move Neil Armstrong will make once he gets down, scooping up an initial sampling of the lunar soil. Later on, bulk samplings will be taken. The single most important instrument to be left on the moon is the seismometer. Scientists feel they can learn a great deal about the origin of the moon, perhaps the origin of the universe, through some of the readings that will be sent back from this seismometer. As you say, it will record earthquakes, it will record strikes on the moon's surface by meteoroids. This instrument is believed to be so sensitive that they expect to pick up the vibrations of the astronauts' footsteps as they move around in the vicinity of it.
Russ, it's this one on the first lunar landing is called the passive seismometer experiment. And the reason is that it is passive. They expect in the future ones, probably on the third landing, to have a seismometer called an active seismometer experiment. It will have, believe it or not, grenades on it. And it will fire out these grenades because of their known explosive force from it onto the surface, and this way they can initiate a seismic signal to send back to Earth. And this seismometer is just as sensitive as the large seismometer stations here, seismic stations here on Earth itself. And they hope to, as you said, get all of the information possible about the moon's wobble and also about moonquakes, meteorite impacts, what have you there on the moon's surface.
NBC Radio's coverage of the flight of Apollo 11 will continue after this message.
Join NBC and the continuous coverage of the Apollo 11 walk on the moon.
Back at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, and we have just received word from Mission Control that there is now no estimate on when the EVA will start. It appears that the crew of the LEM, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, are running a few minutes behind, perhaps as much as 30 minutes behind on the timeline. So we anticipated an EVA, extravehicular activity, to start about 5 minutes from now. It obviously is going to run a little longer. Let's go to Mission Control.
If you'd like to start your event timer, we give you a hack at 10800, over.
We're waiting now for voice communication from the lunar module crew. As we say, things are running behind schedule a little bit. That is, they're running considerably ahead of the initial flight plan, but running behind the new EVA schedule, which was set for approximately 5 minutes from now.
Russ, you mentioned earlier that the various experiments that they would be setting up once they are out of the spacecraft, and of course one of them is that laser reflector. And the question was raised, can a laser beam really pinpoint against a mirror the size of that reflector? And it was pointed out that on the Surveyor 5, which landed in close proximity to where the Tranquility base is located, that laser beams were able to reflect, they were able to aim the laser and reflect it off the surveyor equipment, so there should be no problem in reflecting off that small laser reflector.
Dean, in tests they made, they believe that over this distance of 250,000 miles, they can come within 6 inches accuracy in determining the exact distance between the transmitted beam and the reflected light as it's returned from that laser.
And, of course, the ability to do that, I suppose, has many, many applications, but primarily the measurement of distance between celestial bodies.
That is very important in this particular experiment to determine whether we are moving closer to the moon or away from it, and the relationship and the movements of the moon and the Earth around the sun.
And prosaically enough, one of the very first things that Armstrong will do when he gets out of the LEM is do what a normal pilot always does with his craft. He gets out and he looks around the plane to see that the struts are all there and the tires are there and that the plane survived the landing. And that is precisely what Armstrong will be doing once he descends the ladder here shortly.
The command pilot, Mike Collins, still in orbit around the moon. The other two men, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, on the moon and their lunar module. We had expected them to move out of the lunar module in a matter of a few minutes, but they are now running approximately 30 minutes behind. And since they are running behind by 30 minutes, we're going to rejoin monitor. We invite you to stay tuned to NBC. We expect to return in about 15 minutes for NBC News coverage of man's first walk on the moon. Russ Ward with Dean Mell and Jay Barbary at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
We'll be rejoining NBC for the coverage of the moonwalk in a few minutes. There are two theories about the formation of lunar features, either that the moon's many craters were formed by volcanic action, or that they were formed by material melted by meteors striking the surface of the moon. Scientists are divided on these two theories, and it's possible that there'll be no nearer a solution after the Apollo mission, despite the 100 pounds of samples which the astronauts hope to bring back. To begin with, the landing site was picked for its level terrain, not for its variety of geological samples. One Space Center geologist describes it as a rather blah site as far as samples are concerned, and he says that even if there are craters nearby, they'll probably be too far away for the planned moonwalk because the astronauts aren't expected to stray more than, 100 feet or so from the lunar module. But some scientists are hopeful that the samples that the men bring back will be of scientific value. Another Space Center geologist says the landing site will likely provide good material for research. He says samples from the site itself, plus pieces of rock which could have been thrown from nearby craters, will be invaluable in helping to increase our knowledge of the moon. So there we have two theories. The Apollo 11 moonshot has really caught the imagination of people around the world. There's been some sniping. One British newspaper carried a cartoon showing two starving children looking up at the moon and saying, maybe they'll discover it is made of cheese and bring some back for us to eat. But in the main, it's been praise and adulation for the men and their machine, banner headlines and special editions. In Europe particularly, the moon fever runs high. In England, two songwriters have composed a number which will be sung over the British Armed Forces network in Germany throughout the mission. And in Yugoslavia, a poet and a songwriter have collaborated in what they call a hymn to the cosmonauts to be broadcast over Belgrade radio whenever news of the moon mission is given. In Iran, hippies held a milk and honey party in a Tehran restaurant and drank to the health of the astronauts in, no, not champagne, goat's milk. In Venezuela and Brazil, church bells will be rung when the two astronauts take their first steps on the moon. And in the U.S., the president's proposal for a holiday on Monday has been taken up in many places. In Salem, town officials have gone one stage further. Monday, July 21st, will be Moonday, July 21st. And, Lloyd, this moon dust seems to be a rather unknown quantity. There is some speculation that they might have some trouble with this moon dust in the LEM capsule. What do you think of that?
Yes, this is a new hazard which has just recently come into prominence, and the scientific theorization behind it is as follows. The moon, of course, as we know, has no atmosphere, and the speculation is that when the limb came down, and as we heard earlier, they kicked up a cloud of dust. So when the astronauts go out into what is in the jargon called EVA, extravehicular activity, the walk on the moon, the door, of course, will be open into the limb, and that some of this dust may come into the limb. Well, it's practically certain it will be. Now, once it gets into the landing vehicle, the Eagle, and the astronauts come back and they close the door, they repressurize the cabin, and the atmosphere is more highly oxygenated, or has a higher percentage of oxygen in it than the normal air that we're breathing now. And the speculation, or the possibility, has been raised that in this supercharged oxygen air, that the moon dust might spontaneously ignite and cause all sorts of little flash fires. Now, depending upon the size of the dust and what it happens to be, if it was magnesium, for example, where you have a very high temperature, this could cause, at the very least, discomfort, and at the very most, according to the theorization, real trouble. Now, that's all theory, and we won't know until after they come back.
Yes, of course. But there are so many unknowns that have yet to be revealed. The boys are far from being out of the woods yet.
Oh, absolutely.
And another thing that was mentioned was the possibility of contamination from germs which perhaps have lain dormant in the moon's soil for many years and which might be revived by being in contact with oxygen.